sobering, stimulating, and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program.
Let me get into the one-child policy in China. I want you to think today, this show is about, has always been about economics, geopolitics, music, and motivation, while many people just want me to talk black left activist wacktivism. It's not going to happen. Nor will I be a puppet for the right, a black counterfeit conservative. You gets neither. Broaden your mind, let's go geopolitical, let's circle the globe. Something big going on in China that has a bearing and application on Africa, our people here. Anyone with families should be concerned about demographic issues, laws pertaining to childbirth, fertility, all that stuff. Shanghai calls on chosen couples to exceed China's one-child limit. July 26, 2009. This is coming from the Financial Times. The city of Shanghai is taking the dramatic step of actively encouraging residents to exceed China's famed one-child limit, citing concerns about the aging of its population and a potentially shrinking workforce. The China is looking forward. Now they got themselves into something. Now they have to get out of it. They want to start now. For more than a decade, Shanghai has allowed couples to have two children if each parent was an only child. But few have done so, as rapidly rising incomes in the country's financial capital have been accompanied by falling birth rates. So family planning officials are to nudge eligible parents harder, with plans to push leaflets under doors and make home visits to promote procreation. This is the science of mating, for those that know. We encourage eligible couples to have two kids because it can help reduce the proportion of elderly people. Some 21% of Shanghai's registered population last year was aged 60 or older, which was twice the national average, and births still lag well behind the national rate of 12.14 per thousand. Well, I can't, let me tell you how gangster I am. I've been skipping over a name. I've done it three times now in this article. I can't do it anymore. You would know that I was doing something to edit the article. That's how gangster I am. I can't pronounce this term, so I just skipped it. I think it's Miss Xi. While Ms. Xi cited worries about the city's employment base declining, Li Jinmin, a population expert at Nankai University, said the workforce shortage should be solved through encouraging migrants. But he added that second children could ease the problem of an aging population. So this is one person saying we need more babies in our indigenous population. Another person is saying we need more migrants. What are they dealing with? China is dealing with an aging population. Remember the quote earlier from Ms. Xi that I didn't say was from Ms. Xi. It says, we encourage eligible couples to have two kids because it can help reduce the proportion of elderly people. Kind of like what's going on in America, where you have, what, one employee supporting two retirees through Social Security? Might this be coming to America? Might this be part of the hidden agenda behind immigration laws? Balancing the proportion of elderly people? You don't think that there's wise policymakers in government thinking on a geopolitical level, not on a wacktivist level, but a geopolitical level, saying, hey, our population needs to be so-and-so. We need to reduce it or we need to increase it because of economic factors, among others. Again, some 21% of Shanghai's registered population last year were aged 60 or older, while Ms. Xi said, which Ms. Xi said was twice the national average, and the births still lag well behind the national rate of 12.1 per thousand. This is about economics and survival, self-preservation. Ain't got nothing to do with activism. Chinese children are expected to care for aging parents, but as the current generation of only children reaches maturity, they are increasingly struggling to care for two parents and up to four grandparents. China's decades-old one-child policy, though relaxed in some areas, remains a significant intrusion into private life. 12 categories of Shanghai couples are allowed to have two children, including those whose first child is disabled and those with a spouse who was a fisherman at sea for more than 5 years. The new campaign highlights both the one-child policy and limiting population and the fact that it does not apply to all. In most rural areas, couples have been allowed a second child if the first was not a healthy son. Ethnic minorities are also not limited to one child. Shanghai's initiative follows campaigns to encourage more childbearing in other crowded Asian cities, such as Hong Kong and Singapore, which had previously worked to promote small families, only to see birth rates trail off as income levels matched Western levels. Zero population growth, remember that? Let me hit you with another one. This is an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, July 26, 2009, by Willie Lamb. Rich China, poor peasants. Rich China, poor peasants. What is this about? China recently announced its GDP, gross domestic product, grew by more than 7.1% in the first half of this year, putting the country on course to displace Japan as the world's second largest economy by year's end. But it's not time to celebrate just yet. Peasants and migrant workers who compose more than 65% of China's 1.3 billion people aren't benefiting much from this growth. Much of it is hoarded by the central government. Last year, Beijing collected taxation and other levies of more than 6 trillion yuan, or $878 billion, an eye-popping 4 trillion yuan, that's another way to say it too, renminbi, but we'll just stick with that, more than 5 years ago. Since the turn of this century, funds flowing into the Beijing treasury have increased by around 22% a year, more than double the average 10% GDP growth for the past two decades. This wouldn't be a problem if worker incomes were growing in tandem with tax revenues. But according to official statistics, salaries and other income of workers and peasants declined to just 41.4% of GDP in 2006, the last year when data was available, down from 53% in 1998. Salaries typically equal 50 to 60% of total GDP in developed countries like the United States or Japan. A lion's share of national wealth is being snapped up by about 140 state-held business groups, such as the three oil and gas giants and four major state-owned banks and other government monopolies. Under the nominal control of the State-Owned Asset Supervision and Administration Commission of the central government, the assets and sales of these behemoths grew massively over the 5 years ending 2008. This is Cedric Muhammad. We're talking about the one-child policy in China being reformed. Why? Willie Lam goes on to write, the firms, or these firms, are heavily supported by the government. State-owned banks issued loans worth 1.08 trillion the first half of this year, a figure which exceeds the full year of loans last year. Barely 5% of these loans went to small and medium-sized companies, most of which are privately owned. The central government bars private firms from about a dozen of the most profitable sectors. Today, China boasts around 300,000 super-rich citizens with assets of more than 10 million yuan. This wealth hasn't trickled down. Official statistics show Chinese peasants make about one-third of what their urban counterparts earn. University sociologist Sun Liping estimates that the standard of living discrepancy between cities and the countryside was actually closer to six times. He says the average global urban-rural differential in living standard is around 1.5 times. Poor Chinese face other adversities too. Rural residents are not allowed to permanently settle in cities and cannot enjoy the health, education, and pension payouts taken for granted by urbanites. A 2008 Ministry of Health report said that up to 200 million workers and peasants suffer from occupational ailments. President Hu's mantras including upholding social justice and creating a harmonious society, yet social inequality is yawning ever wider in China. Childbirth increasing among the poor. Is that what China wants? Why? Now, my good friend Reuven Brenner wrote a piece. It's about 10 years old that he just sent me. I want to go over this, talking about China facing up to the realities of what's going on with the population, opening up their society, enabling more entrepreneurship from the bottom up rather than top down. As you can see from that article, China in some respects is very top down. The Communist Party and the state government are in control of a lot of the economic development. China, A Neurotic Prosperity by Reuven Brenner. What can be the point of reference to predict consequences of China's current childbearing pattern, adjusted over the last decades to one kid or you're out of your apartment policy? To make any reliable analyses, one needs at least 2 points so as to draw a straight line as a first approximation. Fortunately for observers, though unfortunately for those who had to adjust to such social engineering, there is not much new under the sun. There has been a government in the past who passed similar regulations. The year was 1726. The place was Austria. The Viennese court, under anti-Semitic pressures, fearing a large increase in the Jewish population, a fear that by itself suggests that the Jewish birth rate at that time was relatively high, introduced a regulation. Only the eldest son of a Jewish family could marry. The younger boys could not. This regulation introduced into the Austrian Empire, including Bohemia, Moravia, and parts of what became later Germany and Alsace, had to or led to the instant migration of young Jewish generations to Eastern Europe, to Poland, to Romania. Whereas within the Austrian Empire, the Jewish birth rates dropped. In Eastern Europe, they did not. How did Jewish parents who stayed adapt to the regulation? As one would expect, they had less children, invested more in their education and health, and probably spoiled them much more than they would have otherwise. One can speculate that this regulation was the origins of the myth of neurotic Jewish mothers and the by now tradition of driving Jewish kids to excellence. True, occasionally to neurotic excellence. Neurosis, we'll talk about that later. Will the Chinese mothers and kids react in a similar fashion? Now, again, now listen, get off of the ideology, the whacktivism. This is geopolitical right now. This is economics right now. Is there a connection between what's going on in China and what the Chinese community and the Jewish community? So Reuven Brenner asked the question, will the Chinese mothers and kids react in a similar fashion? At least this point of reference suggests a positive answer. This one unintended consequence of the one-child regulation will be prosperity driven by kids who will grow up to be very ambitious entrepreneurs. But China isn't Europe. What else can one say by drawing this parallel between the present and distant history? Between the Chinese and the Jewish community is what Reuven is linking. Because of a wide range of other regulations and expecting less than equality before the courts at that time, European Jews have traded among themselves. When they wanted to settle disputes, they turned to religious authorities rather than the courts. Traces of this or these arrangements survive to this day in the still very much Jewish diamond trade. Exchange is still based on complex rules that go back 1,000 years. Contracts are still based on a code of honor that traces its roots to the Old Testament, the Talmud, and the teachings of the Maimonides. I can't say this word. M-A-I-M-O-I-M-O-N-I-D-E-S. Maimonides. Contracts of millions of dollars are concluded by only a handshake and the Hebrew statement Mazal Ubraka, meaning luck and blessing, rather than a written contract approved by lawyers. How does this evidence bear on China? See, a lot of people talk about, well, the Chinese have this and the Jewish community have this, but they can't explain it. There's no science to it. So you can't apply it to anything outside of rhetoric. Reuven asked the question, why and how does this evidence bear on China? Neither Chinese law nor Chinese courts are today reliable institutions. There is no great commercial legal tradition in China, and such tradition can neither be imposed nor created quickly. So how will Chinese expand their family businesses? Whereas in Europe, large families succeeded to pool together their resources and expand family businesses backed by legal institutions, and that's how Western European corporations developed before having access to developed financial markets, this arrangement cannot be done in China for the simple reason that the one-child policy kept families small. There are no brothers, sisters, and for the coming generations, no first cousins. How will then the small family businesses that reach their limits and would like to grow expand? Since it will take long before China will have developed sophisticated financial markets, which do need solid legal backing, the expansion will have to take place through voluntary associations between trusted families. This is what happened among Jews within the larger European community or happened elsewhere in the world among tribes, which for one reason or another were discriminated against, such as the Chinese in Thailand, and where the countries had no reliable legal framework. What shape and form these voluntary organizations will take, I do not know, but people are ingenious in the ways they can adapt, even if the adaptation has long-term neurotic consequences which are not anticipated and whose origin will be long forgotten when they surface. If there is validity in this parallel, China should prosper, though we do not know how long it will take. Recall Shakespeare's Shylock. Below its dramatic surface, that play is about trust versus contracts. Members of a society who know that they must rely on contracts, Jews surrounded by a hostile Europe, find themselves in opposition with Christians, who think that contractual agreements must have an escape clause by just saying, trust me. Shakespeare captured the transition from customs enforced by family, tribe, and religion to one where lawyers and formal dispute resolution mechanisms would have the last word. Only at that time, to him it seemed that customs should have the upper hand and the guide, or rather, and guide the courts too. He did not anticipate the necessary adaptation to a world of growing and more mobile population, where trust becomes an expensive capital to create and sustain. Societies that do not succeed creating institutions to substitute lost trust with enforceable contractual agreements will fall behind. And the slower these institutions are being created, the slower will society prosper. Rubin writes, I do not want to venture into making a prediction about the shape and form of the neurotic prosperity so many single kids of anxious Chinese mothers would bring about, but let there be no doubt. A country filled with 100,000 variations on Freud, combined with 100,000 variations on Woody Allen and Marx, and 100 million falling between the cracks during the transition from paternalist China to a variation on the 18th and 19th century, lacking safety nets type society, brings about a very neurotic prosperity. When 100 million people who have nothing to lose bet on crazy ideas, expect much volatility. It may be interesting to watch, and no doubt some will make fortunes from this volatility. Just remember the Chinese curse. You should live during interesting times. And then Rubin says, one thing the U.S. could do in order not to contribute to this volatility is let the Chinese keep their currency stable and pegged to the U.S. dollar. Monetary mismanagement combined with 100 million people who would have nothing to lose is a lethal combination. Give me your thoughts on that. Is this reform of China's one-child policy an attempt to create more stability, to satisfy a dissatisfied population? As Rubin says, 100 million people with nothing to lose. Is it also an attempt to create a generation of young people that will be able to support an aging population, an increasing elderly population? This article is loaded. Also, lessons that apply to tribal, and we can learn from tribal and ethnic communities in Africa, as well as what's going on in the black community right now as it relates to small businesses that have no more than one paid employee. Rubin asked a great question here. He says, how will then the small family businesses that reach their limits and would like to grow expand? He's saying the fact that you were limited to one child affected the size of the business. This is a mental massage. Think deep about this. Why does the Quran and Mosaic tradition have inheritance laws? Why are inheritance laws so important? Why is there a debate in America over something like the estate tax? What is that really about? It's about the ability for capital to be transferred from one generation to another. Inheritance law is one of the most peculiar and interesting areas of law. Anyway, how does this bear on China? Neither Chinese law nor Chinese courts are today reliable institutions. There is no great commercial legal tradition in China, and such tradition can neither be imposed nor created quickly. So how will the Chinese expand their family businesses, whereas in Europe, large families succeeded to pool together their resources and expand family businesses backed by legal institutions? And that's how Western European corporations developed before having access to developed financial markets. This arrangement cannot be done in China for the simple reason that the one-child policy kept families small. There are no brothers, sisters, and for the coming generations, no first cousins. Now, when you start talking to people that live in Africa, sometimes the children are a form of insurance. You have more children in order to have more workers, more children in order to affect population changes that have happened through war. Children are a form of insurance. They also are the means to expand the economic empire. How will then the small family businesses that reach their limits and would like to grow expand? Since it will take long before China will have developed sophisticated financial markets, which do need solid legal backing, the expansion will have to take place through voluntary associations between trusted families. This is what happened among the Jews within the larger European community. or happened elsewhere in the world among tribes which for one reason or another were discriminated against, such as the Chinese in Thailand, and where the countries had no reliable legal framework. What shape and form these voluntary organizations will take, I do not know. But people are ingenious in the ways that they can adapt, even if the adaptation has long-term neurotic consequences, which are not anticipated and whose origin will be long forgotten when they surface. I'm getting to the root of group economics and kinship system, how wealth is created. China's one-child policy has had the effect of preventing entrepreneurship from occurring on a scale that would make it a more dynamic form of economic development than has been the case, or on the level of what the Jewish community and Europeans experienced. I'll let you meditate on that. Let that marinate. This is a mental massage on the one-child policy in China. This is good geopolitical talk. Go get it. Entrepreneurship Today. July 30th, 2009. It's the hottest show in the diaspora. CedricMuhammad.com, BlackElectorate.com, BlackCoffeeChannel.com. We're going to review the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan's speech on Michael Jackson and his crucifixion. We're going to talk about my favorite show, Tiny and Toya. We'll review T.O.'s show as well. I'm hurt today. The Philadelphia Phillies did not get Roy Halladay. They settled for less. I got a memo here. Strange odor. The management of the residence where I stay sent out a memo called Strange Odor. I need your advice. It's the hottest show in the diaspora. We'll be right back. Some of you are angling. What is this about? It's about a new agenda. I want a new agenda, new relationship. I want entrepreneurship and business and economics and geopolitics on par with activism and voting in one political party. If we could balance that with those four things, it'd be here in a minute. Come on.
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Now it's time for us to take up the slack. Step it up, step it up, time to go to work.
Hold on, I had to bring this back from the top. You all didn't know Janet was getting down like this. Stop looking at her body so much. She is very pretty, but you feel me? Yeah, Janet. New agenda with Chuck D. Y'all must have forgot, as the great Roy Jones Jr. said, try to pigeonhole you. Janet Jackson did not want to conform or fit. Janet Jackson does not want to conform, did not want to fit external limitations and stereotypes surrounding her as an artist where, you know, it was all about how she looked. So this must have been 1993. She got at Chuck D, right? This is on the album Janet. I'm trying to help you all. I usually don't just be this blunt about a song. Listen carefully to what Janet had to say. I may have to put the fire trucks on this to get your attention one more time. Yeah, Michael and Janet throwing hot subliminals. We'll be right back. It's the hottest show in the diaspora. A new agenda, please. Economics, entrepreneurship, and business. Geopolitics, too. Group economics, kinship systems. Let's go. Cedric Mom and Black Coffee Program. What is this? July 30th, 2009. You all know I like, I'm learning Genge music, music out of Kenya. You know, I'm trying to broaden my horizons. My new favorite artist goes by the name of Juakali. All my Kenyan representatives know. I'm learning. They're putting me up on him. But I was looking for some more Juakali music, and I was told that he's making commercials now. He's busy. I guess he's going and getting it. So there's no new hot Juakali material. Now, there's a song I like, Kiasi, but from what I understand, that I was playing lyrics. I was playing a Juakali song that had suggestive lyrics. I know I have a couple friends who speak Swahili, and they broke it down for me. It wasn't nothing raunchy. It's a little, you know what I mean, a little suggestive. So I need a Swahili radio program. But this is it right here. Since Juakali is busy with endorsements, I had to go over to the Ivory Coast. Send in your comments. I want to read them. This is Ataluk and DJ Matrix. I hope I'll have somebody on low later interpret this for me. Let me read your comments. And again, thank you all. I had to go out west for a funeral. Came back. So some of you thought the show was yesterday, even though we put it out. Please sign up for our mailing list, either at CedricMuhammad.com or Black Coffee Channel. Reggie from The Shy says, "Peace, Cedric. Your show has motivated me. I might be leaving my job soon." Reggie, does that mean we got you fired? Or you got a 3-page business plan from CMCAT? He says, "I have a potential business and I need some advice from CMCAT. How can I contact you?" My mailbox is full. Reggie's also in BEEU. I have overdue lessons and I must send out. Coming days, Reg. You want to email me? Reggie, email me at Cedric@CMCAP.com. CEDRIC@CMCAP.com. Shane from H-Town, Houston, Texas. He says, "I feel you. Some people call me an early bird because for so long I was the only person that had to get up in the morning to go to work, so I couldn't hang out late at night like everybody else." Shane, suffering from the effects of being stereotyped. Glenn from Philly, member of the Four Horsemen Squad, along with me, and Bruce from VA. Glenn from Philly says, "P said, in your opinion, is the go-get-it mentality that I think is much needed? Is it often in direct opposition to the stereotypical one-party political ideology way of doing things? In your opinion, is the go-get-it mentality that I think is much needed often in direct opposition to the stereotypical one-party political ideology way of doing things?" Glenn says, "I don't think it has to be, but more often than not, it seems to be that way from my perspective." Oh, some of you all want to look at me. I'm sorry, the camera's not on. Glenn from Philly is making an important point, but we must have a moment of vanity. Oh, yeah, there I go. There I is. Let me handle my biz. Who said that? Was that Biggie? Let me read what Glenn from Philly is saying. For the third time, Glenn says, "In your opinion, is the go-get-it mentality that I think is much needed often in direct opposition to the stereotypical one-party political ideology way of doing things. I don't think it has to be. But more often than not, it seems to be that way from my perspective. Or at the very least, the excessive reliance on one gets in the way of actively going to go get it, like an Andy Reid offense content on passing the ball on every down. Shout to Jim Johnson, the late Eagles defensive coordinator. He just died. Rest in peace to Jim Johnson. To answer Glenn's question, I think that the go-get-it entrepreneurial mentality is in opposition to the stereotypical one-party democratic political ideology way of doing things. Because an evil trick has been played on us. It is that if you are for entrepreneurship, you have to be a Republican. Ooh, oops, did I just say something? Yeah, some activists really under the control of the Democratic Party hierarchy, which is not black, never been black, never will be black. The Robert Strauss legacy, I'll say. Bob Strauss, look it up. They will have anybody who says, go get it, in terms of business and entrepreneurship. Anyone who puts business development on the level of civil rights is automatically labeled a Republican, a conservative, or on the right. Now, that's not what I have in mind. I do think that you'd be out of your mind. You'd be absolutely insane if you think that you should just vote Democratic on every issue and think that that's going to be in the best interest of your business or your life as an entrepreneur. You're out of your mind. You could not justify that to me. If we went through issue by issue, you would have to vote Republican some of the time. If you were truly pursuing an enlightened self-interest, you would have to vote Green Party sometime. You would have to vote Libertarian sometime. If you were truly pursuing an enlightened self-interest. So there is a bit of a trick that goes on that says the person who wants to focus more on entrepreneurial development and business growth and group economics than civil rights. Not that they hate civil rights, they just want to spend less time on that and more time on business. Yeah. You are made to be in opposition to the black left, which is controlled by the non-black left. Good question. Good point, Glenn. I could go a little different direction on that. Maybe later. My dear brother Jeffrey from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He says, peace. My wife says that your solution to policing makes too much sense. So it sounds insane to those who adhere to the social standard. I'm going to read my solution to the police brutality, racial profiling problem that we have. If you really want to solve the problem, later for Skip Gates. I do want to see the Skip Gates t-shirts though. You feel me? I did say that last week and I stand by that. If you all are seeing the arrest of Skip Gates on t-shirts, let me know, because I support that. I support popularizing what happened to him. But I don't think he is the rallying cry. Let's get that picture up. There it is. That's the arrest. Look on your screen. Henry Louis Gates in cuffs. I want that on t-shirts all over the world. Yeah, this is music from the Ivory Coast I'm pumping. Don't hate. I want the Ivory Coast wearing t-shirts of Skip Gates' arrest in Cote d'Ivoire. Any thoughts on the one-child policy in China? Deep implications for entrepreneurship and economic development. Now, somebody tells me this song I'm listening to. It's from DJ Matrix featuring DJ Senator. And they are singing about the importance of taking your life seriously. And also singing about the life in Abidjan. how Cote d'Ivoire is a good place to live and have fun. This is the Coupe de Cali. Coupe de Cali is the name of this music, I think. I want to get into the death of the album story. I want to read about iTunes trying to recreate the heyday of the album. I don't know if it can be done. I want to talk about this music. I think it's coupe. I'm not saying it right. My French is whack. I'll be corrected later on in the program. Somebody will be joining us to break it down. Coupe de Cali, I think this is.
Cedric Muhammad.
Now, some of you may know that the most likely people to go to prison in this country today are young African-American men, right? A few years ago, there was a report that was done by the Sentencing Project indicating that about 25% of all young men between the ages of, 18 and 24 or so were incarcerated. 25%. That was, I think, in 1991. A few years later, the Sentencing Project did a similar report and discovered that within 3 or 4 years, the percentage had soared to over 32%. And by now, that percentage has probably gone up. So we're talking about over one-third of all young black men in this country in prison or directly under the surveillance and control of the criminal justice system. Now, something is wrong with this. Don't you think?
My resolution started when the millennium started, not the year. Street sweepers, come on.
Living in a world of broken dreams, heartaches and pain. Trying to figure it out along the way. I still don't change, but with so much to lose.
Do you think Skip Gates is pumping this, a little Papoose? We'll be right back.
Just to maintain.
The money getting so much shorter now, and I got me a baby daughter now. Time I turn my life around.
They call the black man an ape. They say we resemble gorillas when we gain weight. They say we 3/5 of a man. Get it straight, pack pulse, educate. At the same time, they release the movie King Kong where they kill a black ape. They killed Cookie Williams out in California State. Am I jumping to conclusions, or is it fact proven that they use movies to imitate what they're doing? They gave him the death penalty for killing them. Who gon' get them the death penalty for killing him? It's contradiction. Is Son of Sam out of prison, or is he in jail? Is Charles Manson not a villain? Sammy the Bull admitted to a lot of killing, but they let him live cause he did a lot of snitching. Read the German language, maybe your mind adapt quicker. The definition of Schwarzenegger is black nigga.
Change, but there's so much to lose.
in to the Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, and the Black Coffee Channel.
Purpose and with a destiny bigger than music. We know him. My children knew him from the time he was 10 and came to public attention. My children grew up watching Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, and when they had child show, you know. What? Cartoon of the Michael Jackson and the Jacksons. My children would stay at the TV. They knew all his songs by heart. And we watched him grow. I wish they had the screen so I could show you his growth. At 10, he was black, with a black face, kinky hair, broad nose, thick lips. Somebody told Michael he was ugly. Somebody told my brother he wasn't good looking. Somebody told you the same thing. So you begin to hate the way God made you, but you don't have no money to fix it. So as Brother Michael began to get a little money, he began to try and fix things. Well, I read something. He had about 6 nose jobs. He had a lot of stuff done. He had money, and he was working on himself. I had a conversation with Brother. He said, Minister, they always made us see black people as ugly people in the jungles of Africa. Listen to his words to me. He said, but then I began to study, and I saw that some of these great Egyptian pharaohs, they were beautiful people. He said, and so I went, he said, to my friend Spielberg and David Geffen and others, and I asked them, would they help me to produce a movie on the lives of Africans to show black people how really beautiful we are and were. He said they turned him down, and he said he decided he would do it himself. It was Hollywood whose first movie, what was the first movie? The Birth of a Nation. How did it portray us? And how has Hollywood portrayed us? And who were the Hollywood moguls that portrayed us like that? Am I anti-Semitic, or are they anti-black?
They know our history. And they wanted to keep our history from us so that we would never be inspired to rise above what they had portrayed us as. I didn't write no book called Little Black Sambo. Somebody wrote it for me to read. I'm not anti-Semitic, but they were anti-black. As Michael grew, he began to change. He fixed his nose, he fixed his chin, he took some of the fat out of his jaws. And later on, you know, he contracted this skin disease called vitiligo. They say it first appeared on his hand, and that's why he started wearing the glove. But as you know, vitiligo, it takes away your pigment. And you'll have one part of you very light, almost like an albino. And the other part is natural. Michael, being before the public, he didn't want to be spotted. So he went to dermatologists who sped up the process. So Michael went from black at 10 years old to white in his 40s. They say when he died, his body was chalk white. He was bald from the burn in his hair, so he wore a wig. And they say that the pain that he suffered from that burn is what started him on the pain medication. When Michael had Johnny Cochran as his attorney, I was in Los Angeles, staying at the home of the health guru, Dr. Torrey. And Johnny Cochran called me, and he said, I need you to talk to Michael. He's really going through something. Well, I didn't know what Michael was going through. This was my first conversation with Michael. It was in the 80s. And when I talked to Brother Michael, he was in deep depression. And I said, Michael, out of our pain came our creative genius. I said, if it were not for the pain of slavery, we wouldn't have spirituals, nor would we have blues or gospel. All of it came from our pain. That great gospel song that Martin Luther King wanted to hear the night before he was killed. Precious Lord, take my hand. Was written by a Chicago brother who had just lost his wife. And in losing his wife, he went into the room and his pain brought out that magnificent song. I said, let your pain, Michael, serve your creative genius. That's all I said. After that, Michael came out with the album called History. Now listen, it's serious. Because I didn't know what was giving him pain or who. But when he made that history, he starts talking about the pains. History. How many victims must there be slaughtered in vain across the land? And how many struggles must there be before we choose to live the prophet's plan? Every day, create your history. Every path you take, you're leaving your legacy. Every soldier dies in his glory. Every legend tells of conquest and liberty. Don't let no one get you down. Keep moving on higher ground. Keep flying until you're the king of the hill. No force of nature can break your will to self-motivate. She say this face that you see is destined for history. Then he wrote, they don't care about us. They don't care about us. They who? See, he's sending his people messages out of his pain. They don't care. And some of you are dumb enough to think because we have a black president that they now care. If it does not get better for the least of us, then somebody still doesn't care about us. Skinhead, deadhead, everybody gone mad, situation, aggravation, everybody allegation, in the suite, on the news, everybody dog food, bang bang, shot dead. Everybody's gone mad. All I want to say is that they don't really care about us. Beat me, hate me, you can never break me, will me, thrill me, you can never kill me, Jew me, sue me, everybody do me, kick me, kike me, don't you black or white me. That's what Michael was talking about. They made him go back in the studio and change those words. And Michael was labeled anti-Semitic. Tell me what has become of my life. I have a wife and two children who love me. I am the victim of police brutality. Now I'm tired of being the victim of hate. You're raping me of my pride. Oh, for God's sake, I look to heaven to fulfill its prophecy and set me free. Skinhead, deadhead, everybody gone bad. Trepidation, speculation, everybody allegation. In the suite, on the news, everybody dog food. Black man, blackmail, throw your brother in jail. All I want to say is that they don't really care about us. Tell me
What has become of my rights? Am I invisible because you ignore me? Your proclamation promised me liberty. Now I'm tired of being the victim of shame. They're throwing me in a class with a bad name. I can't believe this is the land from which I came. You know, I really do hate to say it. The government don't want to see. But if Roosevelt was living, he wouldn't let this be. No, no. Skinhead, deadhead, everybody gone bad. Situation, speculation, everybody litigation. Beat me, bash me, but you can never trash me. Hit me, kick me, you can never get me. All I wanna say is, they don't really care. What you don't know is when one of us becomes famous, they watch us closely. Do you remember Different Strokes? Do you remember the little brother called Todd Bridges? I was in the home of Jim Brown, probably one of the greatest football players that ever played the game, and Todd Bridges was there. And he came to me and said, Farrakhan, I was gonna change my name to an African name. And the FBI came and visited me and warned me that I should not do that or else. Why is his desire to change his name a problem for the U.S. government? It's because all of you wear the names of your former slave masters. And as long as you're in the name of your former slave master, you are not yet free. You got to get out of his name and come into the name of God, which you rightly deserve. Michael then was on his way to the cross, because Michael had touched the hearts of people all over the world. Michael touched the hearts of every race, every culture, every ethnic group, every tribe. There was nothing that Michael hadn't touched, and now he's becoming dangerous. Dangerous. Didn't he write some song called Dangerous? He was telling us he had become dangerous. Dangerous to whom? To those who want to keep you ignorant of who you are so they can continue to use us as tools and slaves. It's not about hate. This is not about anti-Semitism. It's about showing who is anti-black.
July 30th, 2009. Thank you for joining me on a Thursday. Maybe we've lost some people and maybe we've gained some people. Does having the show on Thursday create more of a dilemma for you? Let me know. Or does it make it easier for you to tune in? Oh, man. Let's go into hour number three.
Cedric Muhammad.